Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Peter Moore. Today we're heading back a century to the scene of a dangerous and thrilling plot, a plot that might just have changed the course of history. Imagine this. It's September 1918 in Russia. Out of nowhere, a plot bursts forth against Vladimir Lenin and the Bolshevik regime. Less than a year after they came to power in the October Revolution, the Bolsheviks are removed from power and a new government brings Russia back into the First World War. Had Robert Hamilton Bruce Lockhart, a dashing, cynical 30-year-old Scot, been successful, then this is what would have happened. The Lockhart plot of 1918 is now remembered as one of the most breathtakingly audacious ever launched. It was concocted by a triumvirate of British, French and American agents, and its details read like something out of a thriller novel. The Lockhart plot, Love, Betrayal, Assassination and Counter-Revolution in Lenin's Russia, is the title of a new book by the American historian Jonathan Schneer. It was published in hardback in July, and Jonathan Steele, writing in The Guardian, called it a rollicking and thriller-like narrative that captures the chaos and turbulence of post-revolutionary Petrograd and Moscow. A few weeks ago, Jonathan Schneer sat down with our very own John Hillman to tell us much more about how the whole daring story played out. Here is Jonathan taking us on a travel back through time.
So thanks so much for coming on again. And so today we're going to be talking about the Lockhart plot, a story of love, betrayal, assassination and counter-revolution. What an amazing story. I mean, I was gripped throughout, really. I felt as if I was reading one of John le Carré's kind of George Smiley novels at times. So congratulations on the book. It's a fantastic read. Can I just start by getting you to tell us a little bit about the story, perhaps what it was that drew you to it in the first place?
Yes, sure. The story, in essence, is the story of it. There are two stories. There's a spy story and a love story. Young Bruce Lockhart, he was about 30 years old in 1918. I think he was 31, was sent to Russia, having been previously a British consul in Moscow for about 4 years, to Russia by Lloyd George. He had come back to London previously to make contact with the Bolshevik government. All the Allied governments had withdrawn recognition because they hated what the Bolsheviks stood for, but all of them had to talk to the Bolsheviks, and one way or another, they all did. And the way that the British government wanted to do it was through an unofficial envoy, Robert Hamilton Bruce Lockhart. And Lockhart accepted this job, and the job precisely was to persuade the Bolsheviks to stay in World War I against Germany, or failing that, to try to persuade them at least to make a peace with Germany that didn't hurt British interests. Lockhart got to Russia, to what was then called Petrograd, at the end of January 1918, and he quickly discovered that the Bolsheviks would not listen to what the British wanted them to do. They had their own ideas. And so after some fretting, Lockhart came up with a plan, and the plan essentially was to overthrow the Bolsheviks, to kill Lenin and Trotsky, and to substitute a regime that would do what the British wanted it to do, namely restart the war so that Germany would face conflict on two fronts, east and west. So the first part of the story, or a major part of the story, is the story of the concocting of this plot and the stymieing of the plot by the Russian CHK, the Russian secret police.
Right.
The substrata of the story is the torrid romance that Bruce Lockhart conducted while he was doing all this other stuff with a beautiful and somewhat mysterious woman named Moira von Benkendorf, who was already married, who had two children. Lockhart, by the way, was married as well. But their romance provides a backdrop to the scheming that was going on during the late winter, spring, and summer of 1918 in Russia.
Right, and I mean, it was quite an intense relationship as well, wasn't it? I mean, they were actually living together throughout this period. I mean, it wasn't really just an affair, was it? I mean, there was a lot more happening. She was very much in love with him. She wanted to leave Russia with him in the end. There was a child involved here, and really interesting aspect of the whole story, I thought, was this relationship with Maura. And you know, what influence did she have? I mean, there seems to be quite a lot of, we're not quite sure, are we, how much she knew about what was happening at the time and whether she was involved or not, whether she was even working for the Cheka. I mean, she was a very well-connected person. I found her like a really fascinating character, actually.
Well, she's an astonishing figure. She is every bit as astonishing a figure as Bruce Lockhart, who nearly changed the course of history. And yes, she was well-connected. All her life, she was well connected, and I knew her daughter, who was equally well connected.
Ah, you actually met her daughter.
Yes, through it's actually, I think I mentioned that either in the conclusion to the book or in the introduction to the book. That's one reason why I wrote the book. I got to know the daughter, and in fact, she was many years older than I, obviously. Right. But I would stay at her house for about 15 years every time I went to England to do research for one book or another.
I think we should just jump in, shall we? And straight into the first scene. So let's just start by asking, as we ask all our guests, if you could travel back through time, what year would you pick?
Yes, well, obviously, I would pick 1918 in order to be there so that I could have written the book even better. And the first date that I think you were going to ask me to specify is February 15, 1918, which was the day that Lockhart, who had been in Russia for 2 weeks by now, but that was the day when he finally got to meet the equivalent of a British foreign secretary, the foreign commissar, Leon Trotsky.
Right. Yes, a very famous individual. So, I mean, what was actually, if you could just for our listeners describe it, what would it have been like at that time in Petrograd, which is St. Petersburg? It must have been an incredible place to be at that moment in history.
Right. So, first of all, it would have been very, very cold.
Yes.
when Lockhart arrived and was brought on a horse-drawn sled to his hotel. Actually, I think he spent the first couple of nights at the British Embassy there. They passed frozen horses on the street.
Wow.
Petrograd was a barely functioning city, I think you could say. The Bolsheviks had only been in power for a few months. They had not yet exerted control. The country was in free fall. There was nobody shoveling snow off the streets. The streetcars were completely unreliable. They went wherever the driver felt like driving. It didn't matter what they said. But also people were starving. All the infrastructure had broken down. There was hyperinflation, so that potatoes cost, I think it was 50 times what they had cost before the war. I read how one British newspaper reporter was shocked because a chicken cost £1, the equivalent of a pound. In today's pounds, it would be 56 pounds for a chicken.
Yeah.
And basically, they were eating black bread. So it was really a mess. And that's what Lockhart saw when he got there. And he wrote back to his wife, whom, by the way, he soon would be two-timing. How much he missed her and how shocked he was at the way Petrograd now appeared.
Because it wasn't the first time he'd actually been to Russia. Is that correct?
He was the British consul. Mm. He was first a junior consul in Moscow, starting in 1912 as one of the very youngest consuls, I'm sure, in the British consular service. Mm. And he actually became the leading consul in Moscow when the senior man had to leave due to illness.
Right.
They didn't replace him. And that was because he was, in fact, a brilliant consular official. And he wrote back the most extraordinary reports. So his reputation was very high. He had been there from 1912 until 1917. They sent him home because he was having an illicit affair. He was married. Oh, his absolutely. Wife had come with him.
There's a bit of a theme here, isn't there, with this?
Yes, there is. He was a rogue. There's no way around it. He was a rogue.
Right. And so it must have been, you know, sort of incredibly shocking for him to then come back, you know, because he's at the kind of tail end of sort of Tsarist Russia. He's living a very kind of privileged life, I would imagine, in Moscow. So to come back to Russia at the sort of tail end of the First World War and to see the devastation around him, it would have been a pretty shocking moment. But surprisingly, he was quite positive about the Bolshevik regime, it would seem.
Well, he was never a Bolshevik. He believed, and I think probably rightly, that only the Bolsheviks at that point had the wherewithal to govern the country. The Tsar and his supporters had been completely discredited, and Lockhart knew the Russian liberals, who in fact had helped to overthrow the Tsar and who initially governed the country. And he basically said they're not the kind of people who can make a revolution succeed. They're not tough enough and well enough organized. And the same with the sort of moderate socialists, for example, Kerensky. He was very suspicious, not of Kerensky's motives or of his, principles or goals, but he just didn't think these were people who could govern the country. And so he thought that Britain really should make the best of it with the Bolsheviks and try to win them over, and that maybe that way they could, in fact, be persuaded to join the war again.
Right, and it's with it's really a great moment to sort of go to our first scene, I think, because here is Lockhart, and he's, you know, he's with that in mind, with this idea of cooperation with Russia, sort of he arrives. So perhaps you'd like to tell us about your first scene that you've chosen to visit.
So the Bolsheviks had established their headquarters at the Smolny Institute, which had previously been a very fancy school for the wealthiest young women of Petrograd. And so they've taken over the school, and from everything I've read, it was pandemonium in there. There were, first of all, you have to understand that they were, many of them were idealistic young people, men and women. They've just taken over this country. They have their chance to show that socialism, real, you know, socialism, revolutionary socialism, can work, but they are besieged from all sides by hostile forces pecking away at the old Russian Empire, obviously. So in that big building, they're rushing through hallways and they're smoking cigarettes and they're taking dictation and so on and so forth.
I was going to say, there's a lovely line that you write where it says, I've got it here actually, this little quote, it says, "They rushed from room to room carrying papers, folders, dossiers. They were making history despite the Germans, despite the Allies, despite their homegrown enemies. Consciously, excitedly, they were fashioning the world's first communist state." And it's a glorious image, really.
And Lockhart arrived carrying a copy of Das Kapital.
I love that. That's such a great... It's a kind of trying to fit in, just sneaking in with his copy of Das Kapital under his arm. I found it amazing the way Trotsky had a... when he arrives at his outside of his office, he has a sort of scrap of paper tacked to the door with People's Commissary for Foreign Affairs kind of scribbled in pen, kind of tacked to that's his office at this stage.
Compare it to the Foreign Office in London. Right?
Yeah, it's incredible, scene, really, isn't it?
Yes. And then I think the room itself is, you know, nothing much. And Lockhart notices that it has, I think, a desk and a wastebasket and a couple of telephones and a chair for him. I mean, just not like going into the Foreign Office to talk with Balfour or something.
No. So, I mean, it must have been a really, they've got quite a tenuous grip, haven't they, at this point? I mean, there's a great moment. I think it's not actually in this scene where you write about, I think it's Szynski or Peters. I can't remember which one, but they have the Chequers annual budget locked in their desk drawer, which is
they're a bunch of guys trying to work this out. And none of them have, or hardly any of them have any experience. They've always previously been underground revolutionaries or escaping from Siberia or something like that.
Yes, absolutely.
But the essence of the meeting between Trotsky and Lockhart on that day is that Trotsky says, yes, we'd like to, I mean, we don't trust the British any more than we trust anybody else, but mm-hmm. There's room for cooperation between us, because he says, something like, I can't fight the whole world at once.
Sure.
So, and Lockhart seizes on that and thinks that that means that he can make a success of his mission.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of turned up, and there is this kind of window of opportunity, isn't there, because of there's a bit of a crisis going on within the Bolshevik Party at the time because of the peace process with Germany. Sure. Brest-Litovsk. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about that, what was actually happening and going on in the Bolshevik Party at this time.
So the thing was, Russia just didn't have an army anymore. Mm-hmm. Everybody, all the soldiers were throwing down their weapons and going home.
Right.
So the Russians could not resist the Germans if they invaded further. And Trotsky knew that, and he went and tried first to persuade the Germans to stop, but then eventually came up with this program, I guess you would say, a policy, which was no war, no peace. They couldn't fight the Germans, but nor would they sign the incredibly punitive peace treaty that the Germans were forcing them to take. But the leaders of the Bolshevik Party split, and there were some who said, what we have to do is retreat the government behind the Urals and conduct a guerrilla war against the invading Germans.
Right.
And Trotsky was basically saying, as I said, no war, no peace. We'll let them invade if necessary. We can't resist them, but I won't sign the treaty.
Right.
And Lenin was saying, you're all foolish, because there is no way we can resist them, and we must sign the peace treaty.
Right.
And Trotsky and a couple of his supporters abstained, and the war party, which was led by Bukharin, mm-hmm. lost by, I think it was just one vote, to the followers of Lenin, who insisted that they accept the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk.
Because there was a kind of suspicion that Lenin was working for Germany, wasn't there? I mean, or certainly rumors. I don't know how much the rest of the kind of leading Bolsheviks believed, or if anybody actually believed in those rumors at all. But there was this kind of idea that, you know, he was in some way working on
sure.
the side of Germany.
The Allies had every reason to be suspicious of the Bolsheviks, because what did they do? They took one of the main Allied powers out of the war.
Yeah.
So they were helping Germany doing that. And I think, well, put it this way, the Bolsheviks, who had been in hiding and refugees, emigres from Russia when World War I began, wanted to get back to Russia. Lenin was living in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they worked out a deal with the Germans so that Lenin and a bunch of his followers were allowed to take a train that went through Germany on its way to the Finland station in Petrograd. So that's where the whole thing about German gold comes from.
Right, right, yeah. And so at this moment, you have German troops are also kind of, they're getting quite close to Petrograd, aren't they? And
yes.
There's a lot of, it kind of reminds me very much of these parallels with World War II, really, when the Germans invaded and there were many kind of Russians tearing up their party cards because they were so fed up with living under Stalin. And it almost seems like here there's the same kind of atmosphere of Russian kind of middle and upper classes feeling like, great, the Germans are going to set us free from these terrible Bolsheviks, and it's all going to, you know, and so there's quite an atmosphere going on, isn't there?
Yes, you're describing it correctly. Yes, you're talking about Russians being sympathetic to the Germans. The Bolsheviks were trying to abolish all class distinctions and class privileges, and they were going to confiscate wealth, and they were going to nationalize the economy. And so there were plenty of upper class people and middle class people who thought they were a plague and who therefore did welcome the prospect of a German army sweeping them from power. But there were also plenty of upper class and middle class Russians who hoped that the British and the French would somehow sweep the Bolsheviks from power.
In this scene that we're visiting, I mean, you have Lockhart trying to convince Trotsky that there is the way that we could work together. I think you'd say Trotsky kind of laughs at him, really, doesn't he? And he's kind of wily enough to know that the British aren't really, but you know, going to support the Bolsheviks unless it kind of suits them. Which
there can be a coincidence of interests, which is to say, the Russians needed, the Bolsheviks needed British economic support. Mm-hmm. The British wanted to strip three ports, which had all kinds of war material and other resources, because they were afraid the Germans would take them, especially Murmansk and Archangel in the northwest. So the basis for some kind of an agreement, it had nothing to do with love, as Trotsky says to Lockhart. It has everything to do with you need that and we need this, and so we can come to some kind of an agreement. And then Lockhart says, wires that back to Balfour in the Foreign Office and says, this is the basis for our kind of a working relationship, and we can build upon it. But the problem is that the Foreign Office is full of not only people who would like to see that work, but I think a majority of people who just thought the Bolsheviks had to be overthrown anyway.
Hello, I'm Peter. At Travels Through Time, we're incredibly proud to be partnering with Jordan Lloyd, who's one of the world's leading visual historians. His extraordinary photo colorization work has appeared on the covers of National Geographic, Life, and People magazine. And the quality of his work and his attention to detail really has to be seen to be believed. There are portraits of Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln. There are sweeping panoramas of scenes like the D-Day beaches. And one of my own personal favourites is a colourised shot of RMS Titanic at that moment when she's cutting loose from her moorings in Southampton in April 1912. Travels Through Time listeners can now buy any one of these brilliant prints at a discount at his website, colorgraph.co. Just enter the discount code TTT and get 10% off any order.
That's brilliant. So if we park that scene for a moment and leave that there, and perhaps we could move on to the next one that you'd like to take us to.
Okay, the second scene is on August 25, so it's nearly 6 months later, isn't it? Or more than 6 months later.
Right.
The scene is the American consulate in Moscow. And by this time, Lockhart has launched his plot and things are moving forward. And Lockhart was working with American and French agents. And he has by now set just about everything into motion. So at the American consulate on the night of August 25, there was a meeting presided over, actually, not by the American consul, whose name was DeWitt Clinton Poole, but by French consul general, whose name was Fernand Grenard.
Right.
Attending the meeting were Americans and French and British, not Lockhart, and also one Latvian, as I can explain. And what exactly was going on has never been absolutely explained, but with 99.999% certainty, the people at the meeting were sort of going over their plans for overthrowing the Bolsheviks.
Right.
So it's astonishing, first because some of the French agents who are in that room talk about how they are going, they're going to blow up bridges so that food cannot be transported to the starving people of Petrograd or Moscow, I forget which, and how they have poison for poisoning livestock. Mm-hmm. And then one of the British agents, who is none other than Sidney Reilly, the, you know, history's ace of spies, possibly the prototype for James Bond, as far as Ian Fleming was concerned, he talks also about blowing up, you know, railway bridges and railways, and
yes,
and that the French consul general had made a mistake.
Yes.
Grenard, had invited a cuckoo into the nest without realizing it. He had invited a journalist named Marchand, mm-hmm. whom he thought to be an agent and had journalism as a cover. But in fact, Marchand was a Bolshevik sympathizer, mm-hmm. although a Frenchman. And he was absolutely appalled by what he heard at this meeting. And afterwards, he went and talked to the head of the Cheka about what had just happened.
And this is Dzerzhinsky, isn't it? The head of the Cheka.
Yes.
I think it's one of the things that really strikes me about this part of this book is quite how much he kind of controlled the whole situation. It was almost this plot really never stood a chance, did it? It was, Dzerzhinsky really was the man in control of this from the get-go. He kind of put the agents, his agents, in amongst Lockhart, in amongst Captain Crombie, who we haven't spoken about. But it was almost like he was kind of, I think there's I think you write, there's a really nice line actually where you say you can imagine Dzerzhinsky at this point alone in his room at Lubyanka late at night, kind of rereading reports and planning what to do once he had the letter from Marchand. And, you describe satisfaction shining from his hooded, bloodshot eyes. And it's, I think it's just one of the things that really struck me is it's how much he was kind of lauded as a hero, wasn't he? I mean, Iron Felix, and I guess because he died young. Or younger, he didn't have a chance to kind of fall victim to Stalin's purges, so he's very much remembered as a great Russian hero. But he was very much in control, wasn't he? I mean, it never really felt at any time like this plot was going to really succeed because he was the one that was kind of controlling all the pieces.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Or I think you're right. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. It is true that Dzerzhinsky and Lenin, all the top Bolsheviks knew that the Allies were plotting against them and would do whatever they could to overthrow mm-hmm. them. So that was understood. And they had reason to be suspicious of Lockhart and of the French and of the Americans. Mm-hmm. Lockhart, whose activities I know best, had been in touch with all kinds of counter-revolutionaries once he realized that the only way to get Russia back into the war would be to overthrow the Bolsheviks and install a different regime. So what Dzerzhinsky did precisely was to dangle before the potential schemers, or the schemers whose scheme had not yet crystallized, agents who the Allies, and Lockhart in particular, would think could pose the key, could be the key to a counter-revolution. But all the while, those agents were reporting back to Dzerzhinsky.
Yeah, it is quite incredible. And I guess something else I'd like to ask you about this is, one thing that also really struck me is how everything seemed to hinge on this group of soldiers called the Latvian Rifle Brigade.
That's right. The Latvian Rifle Brigade was the sort of Praetorian Guard of the Bolshevik regime. They relied upon it whenever they faced a real crisis. They had not thrown away their weapons. I think one reason is because they were so far from home, they could never have gotten home. Right. So they stuck it out. But they also were apparently very well organized, very well disciplined, very well armed and well officered soldiers. But Germany had occupied Latvia. Then the Bolsheviks had surrendered to Germany at the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And many of the soldiers in the Latvian Rifle Brigade considered that a betrayal. And what they wanted to do most of all was to go back to Latvia. If they had to fight anybody, they didn't want to be fighting the Bolshevik battles anymore. They wanted to fight the Germans in order to free their country, Latvia. So that was the line that Lockhart used to persuade Latvian officers to support his coup. The problem was the Latvian officers he was persuading were actually working for Felix Dzerzhinsky. He got the wrong officers.
Yes.
Yeah. If he had gotten different ones, things could well have turned out differently.
Dzerzhinsky sent these Latvian riflemen to Petrograd. I think if memory serves me correctly, they go to a bar or a party being hosted, and just kind of introduce themselves and say, "Oh yeah, we're not happy," and they're kind of welcomed into this, you know, huge international conspiracy. Really, it's quite amazing, really.
Well, yes. What they went to a Latvian social club is what they went to. So they were sort of naturals there. And as it happened, they were attracted to that social club because there was free food and drink. Mm. And it was paid for by some men who would sit in the back of the room and talk to each other and didn't mix much with the riffraff, the rank and file right. Latvian soldiers and sailors who were there. And so it didn't take too long before they were posing as former officers, although they were Chaka men. Actually, they were former Latvian officers. So pretty soon they discovered that they could talk in the same language, and the language was a language of anti-Bolshevism. Right. And that was what eventually, it took a couple of months, but eventually they were brought into the plot, in that they were introduced to the man you mentioned earlier, Captain Cromie, who was the British military attaché, a former submarine commander, now the military attaché in Petrograd.
Right.
And Cromie was working with Lockhart on the plot. And Cromie, in fact, was the man who wound up introducing the Latvians to Lockhart.
Right. And this is all basically being kind of instigated by Zelensky. And it kind of has real parallels with almost with Putin today. I often think that Putin must have studied Zelensky quite a lot.
Yes, right. Well, if he reads my book, he'll find it doesn't always turn out the way you want.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. So on that moment, should we fast forward to your next scene, which is really interesting moment. So if you'd like to take us to where we go next, I'm sure that doesn't.
Yeah, it's only six nights later after that meeting at the consulate. And now we're in Lockhart's flat, which was number 24 Klebny Perelouk. I may be mispronouncing since I don't know how to speak Russian. I have seen through Google Maps, I have been able to find it, and it's a very, very upscale neighborhood, and it must have been a beautiful building back even in 1918. And so he had a flat in it, and he was living there at that point with Moura von Benkendorf and another British officer who was attached to the embassy. So they're lying in bed asleep on the night of August 31. However, on the morning of August 30, in Petrograd, a young former officer, a young man, a poet named Leonid Kenegisser, shot and killed the head of the Petrograd Chaka.
Yes.
He did that probably because the Chaka had arrested and executed a friend of his, possibly his lover. That's the evidence is a little bit mixed on that. So that's number one. So that day, Lenin told Dzerzhinsky to go find out the links between Kanagisser and the plot that Dzerzhinsky was following and whose agents had penetrated. So he took the train from Moscow to Petrograd and interrogated Kanagisser, but could get nothing from him.
Right.
And it's evening, and that very evening back in Moscow, Lenin was giving a speech at an armaments factory, and he walked out of the building. Somebody shot Lenin and nearly killed him. Three bullets, one in his lung, one in his shoulder, one went through his coat and struck another woman. It was not clear whether Lenin would live or die. The person whom the police caught and who certainly was involved in some way was a young woman named Dora Kaplan, sometimes called Fanny Kaplan.
Yes.
Whether she actually pulled the trigger is not clear. But anyway, the point is Dzerzhinsky's rocketing back in the train from Petrograd to Moscow, having heard that Lenin was shot after having gone the other direction first to talk to Kanagisser about shooting, he jumped to the conclusion that these two assassinations, or one assassination and one attempted assassination, were connected to the Lockhart plot.
Right.
And so he told his men to pounce. So the next day begins the Red Terror. Mm. So that evening, Lockhart and Moora and the other British officer Hicks are asleep in that apartment at Klebni Pereluk, and the Cheka sends a young agent named Pavel Malkov with search warrant number 6370 for the morning hours of September 1, in other words, just past midnight, to go arrest Lockhart and, well, the people in number 24, Klebni Pereluk. So Lockhart, Hicks, and Moora are all arrested. And that's the other scene that I thought I should describe to you.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been a terrifying moment for them to have that knock on the door.
Actually, the way it worked is that Lockhart was sleeping like a log, but Moora woke up and wouldn't let them in. And they had but then she must have been an incredibly tough person.
Right.
But then Hicks awakened and let them in. And then Lockhart writes that he woke up and saw 12 men standing with revolvers pointed at him,
right,
which is not true, because I happen to know that there were, because I've seen who was there, and it was Pavel Malkov and the building superintendent and one other Cheka man. So there were probably two or three men. Even so, it was a rude awakening, shall we say.
Yeah, shall we? I mean, this was the start of the Red Terror, as you mentioned. I mean,
yes,
this is quite a moment, isn't it? Because it wasn't just Lockhart and Moora that were round. I mean, this is when they start rounding up everyone, just lots and lots of foreign nationals in Moscow and Petrograd, don't they?
Yes. Well, they've been doing some of that before, but this is unlike anything that Russia has seen from the Bolsheviks. They were not only locking up, as you say, conspirators or people they suspected of conspiracy, but they were essentially locking up foreign nationals in order to hold them hostage, because they feared that there was going to be an invasion, and there was going to be an invasion, and they feared counter-revolution. But also, they were just locking up anybody with any connection, not even to the conspiracy, but whose class origins made them suspicious. I remember a terrible, terrible quote from one of the leading Bolsheviks named Zinoviev, and it was something to the effect that there were 100 million people in Russia, and they only cared about 90 million of them, and the other 10 million were dispensable. Now, the number killed in this first Red Terror is nothing like that. It's in the hundreds, maybe in the low thousands. Again, the historians argue about that. But it's a terrible, terrible harbinger of what will come later.
I believe so. I have quite a chilling quote from the book, which is one of the senior Czechists says to his agents, "Do not look in the file for incriminating evidence to see whether or not the accused rose up against the Soviets with arms or words. Ask him instead to which class he belongs. What is his background, his education, his profession? These are the questions that will determine the fate of the accused." And I mean, that's just a terrifying thing to read, because, you know, you can put yourself in their shoes, and suddenly you find yourself on the wrong side of wrong side of the argument, and suddenly you're being there's a knock on your door, and you're being taken away, and there's no protection. The state is turned on you, and it's just must have been such a terrifying thing to live through.
Probably even if you supported the Bolsheviks, if you were the wrong class. It's awful.
And so this is the moment really where that kind of paranoia that kind of defined the Soviet Union, particularly through my lifetime growing up in the sort of 80s, particularly, you can that idea that that suspicion of the West, this still exists to this day. The actual Lockhart plot, you could say, really was that moment where the relation, that kind of paranoia, that kind of relationship was kind of set in a way, wasn't it, with the West. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I imagine that the great powers meddled in each other's affairs for years and years and years before, for centuries. Nevertheless, This attempt to overthrow a regime that still the majority of Russians supported, I think, set a terrible precedent, for sure. And we're living, I mean, it's not that we're living with the direct consequences. Putin would be doing his meddling, I think, if Bruce Lockhart had never existed. But nevertheless, there is a line that runs from 1918 to 2018 and 2020 and 2016 and so on. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, one of my good friends is a Lithuanian and grew up there in the 70s and 80s, and he held the record for stripping a Kalashnikov and putting it back together again, which they taught you at primary school because they were so convinced that the West was going to invade, you know. And it was fascinating about this for me, this idea that this is the moment where it all kind of began, really. Quite terrifying. And thanks so much for that. And I guess we touched briefly on this really interesting character, didn't we? The Ace of Spies. I'd like to ask you, if you were to be able to bring back a memento from this period, what would it be?
Well, so after Lockhart was busted, the morning after Lenin was shot, the Petrograd CK went into the British embassy, because they had word that there were some of the plotters there, and there was a gun battle, and Captain Cromie, whom I've mentioned to you, was killed. Riley was in Petrograd at the time, and he fled. And that day, or that night, which is just before Lockhart was arrested, he wrote a report summarizing what the plotters had achieved, what had gone wrong, and how the plot could go forward. And sadly, I can't find that document, and nobody can find that document. If I could bring back a memento, that's the one I would choose, because it really would I think, open the whole thing up. But whether he ever delivered it to Lockhart, I don't know. Whether he ever sent it to the Foreign Office, I don't know. Certainly, I've searched everywhere I can think of, and I've never found a trace of it.
You'd have to take it off of Sidney Riley, which would braver man than I am, if you were to attempt that.
Right.
But so it could be anywhere. It could be hiding. It could be under some floorboards in an apartment somewhere in Russia. We just don't know. So it would
be amazing. You know, the other possibility is that he never wrote any such document at all, because he was a big time liar.
So Sidney Riley, that's not his real name, is it? He wasn't even British, I think.
He was born Shlomo Ben Hirsch Rosenblum.
Right.
And I think it was somewhere in Russia. So he has an extremely checkered career, and there are biographies of Riley, but he lied about absolutely everything, including, he claimed at one point, he had gotten a chemistry degree at Cambridge, which is, you know, impossible. but he made various fortunes. He collected Napoleonic memorabilia. He was almost certainly some kind of a sociopath, without making real connections to people. But he was extremely charming, and he married four different women, never divorcing any of them. In other words, he was a serial bigamist. But he had, I think, one genuine belief, and that was a hatred of Bolshevism.
Right.
And in fact, after the war, he sold off his collection of Napoleonic memorabilia in order to finance the anti-Bolshevik movement, or to help finance it. And of course, as you know, he was lured back into Russia by Felix Dzerzhinsky and executed.
His great nemesis. Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating. Yes. I mean, so on that note, I mean, we finish by discovering that James Bond was Russian. So that's really fascinating stuff. John, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast. I think this is a fascinating book for anybody interested in Russian history, or anybody indeed who likes a really good rollicking spy thriller. This is just a great read. I know it's been fantastically well received. And I've really enjoyed reading it. I've really enjoyed discussing it with you today. And yeah, thank you very much for coming on Travels Through Time.
It was my pleasure, and I enjoyed our conversation too.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was Jonathan Schneer talking with John Hillman about his new book, The Lockhart Plot, Love, Betrayal, Assassination and Counter-Revolution in Lenin's Russia. The book is hugely recommended by all of us here at Travels Through Time, and it's available now in hardback from Oxford University Press. Do head to our website, which is tttpodcast.com, to discover more information related to the scenes, people and histories included in this episode. If you're interested in the history of World War One, you'll also find episodes there on the suffragettes in 1914, the home front in 1916, and the Bloomsbury Group in 1917. We're just missing an episode on 1915 to complete our First World War set, so if you'd like to suggest an author or a story, please do feel free. I'm going to be back next week with a trip to the Dutch Golden Age, talking to the author Hugh Aldersey Williams about the polymath Christopher Huygens. But for now, that's it. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.